concerned with moolah.
You don't know how you're supposed to earn it, or what to do with it, or how to keep it. You're a freak with a dark, shameful secret.
But you're not the only one. Hit your hidden financial fears with a blast of sun. Now your healing has begun. It's Bad with Money with Gabby Dunn.
Hello, everyone. I'm Gabby Dunn, and this is Bad with Money. Well, we heard from you guys. I mean, we kind of always hear from you guys, but this time we asked to hear from you guys about your changing relationship with money during COVID-19. Obviously, we always get a lot of feedback on our episodes. We have an email address, gabbyisbadwithmoney@gmail.com, which you guys write into, leave comments, all of that. Although specifically in the last couple weeks, I asked you guys to write about what's going on with you. Send us an audio message or a short email about how your relationship to money has changed during this mind-blowing, tragic time. Obviously, it's on the forefront of everyone's minds. How are you going to make money? What's going on with work from home? What's going on with unemployment? What medical bills are going to look like during this time? All kinds of stuff. You can't get away from it. It's in the news constantly. So we thought we would get individual listener stories and have you guys tell us what you're going through. And then since I'm only like, I would say 25% of an expert, I brought on financial therapist Amanda Clayman to help me give you guys advice, talk to you about your specific situations, broaden the questions out to talk about how this particular issue is affecting many, many, many people. And also therapize, get a little therapized. Anytime I can get you guys therapy for free, I will do it. And that's the Gabby Dunn guarantee. So here is our interview with Amanda Clayman, who is the host of Financial Therapy with Amanda Clayman, which is through the Death, Sex, and Money podcast feed. You should go check that out. And Amanda and I are going to answer some questions and give you guys advice. And mostly it will be Amanda, who's a professional, and me, a person who somehow has this show. So, can you tell our listeners who you are and what you do?
Yes, absolutely. My name is Amanda Clayman. I am a financial therapist.
What is a financial therapist?
A financial therapist is somebody who helps people bring money into balance by looking at the emotional and the cognitive and behavioral and even relational aspects that go into our financial well-being.
And you're the host of Financial Therapy with Amanda Clayman from WNYC Studios, Death, Sex, and Money.
Right.
Which we have had Anna Sale on this show before. And we've also had other financial therapists on the show before. And I think people don't consider that a lot of issues may stem from or relate to money. So what sort of things do you see as a financial therapist? What are the common things people come in for?
People usually come to me sort of via two different channels. Either there is some sort of like inflection point in their life. So maybe something big around partnering or having a child, switching careers. So the things that were working for them, like strategies, like go-to kind of habits and routines with money, are no longer working in these new set of circumstances. And the other sort of pathway through which people come to me is if there has been something in their life that has been not working to some degree for a really long time, and all of a sudden that not working has gotten intolerable, or they've kind of run out of time and runway to fix it.
Yeah. So obviously you're talking about like big things changing and causing changes to our relationships to money, which everyone is experiencing right now because of COVID-19. But before any of that, like how complicated are our relationships with our money just in normal times?
That's a funny question to answer, because when you say something is complicated, there's almost like a little bit of an undertone that complication or the complicated relationship mm-hmm. is not a good thing. Like it's something that we have right. to work on and fix. And I actually take the view that money is an interesting and super useful lens for us to just be able to look at our lives. Because we, first of all, money touches basically every everything that we do, like how we work and how we identify with our work, how we support ourselves or our families, like the status we have in the world, the ways that we spend money to take care of ourselves, like literally life maps onto money in some mm-hmm. pretty fundamental and ubiquitous ways. And at the same time, we project a tremendous amount of meaning onto money as well. So I find money super useful as a therapist to be able to like help people drop in to the choices that they're making, and see what parts of themselves get revealed through those choices that might otherwise have been very difficult for them to see. And also to be able to work with money in some interesting ways so that they can experience like internal changes or even internal transformations.
Yeah, I agree about the word complicated. We've talked about on the show many times that our relationship to money is like a dovetailing sort of snowballing, like, it's how we feel about ourselves. And then for me specifically, I've talked about in my book having bipolar 2 and how mania causes you to spend and then how depression causes you to spend and how you feel about your own money situation indicates what you're going to do. So like for me, when I didn't want to look at it and didn't know anything about it, I would just ignore everything that had to do with money. And then that caused more problems and more problems and more problems. And so a lot of people who were, I think, before the pandemic, feeling very good about their money situations, at least from what we heard from our listeners, they either have maintained that and feel guilty or they've completely lost that and are just totally lost. So I did ask our listeners for some of what's going on with them during this time. And so we're going to hear some of their real experiences. And then I would love to talk about those with you.
Great.
Because you're a professional therapist and I'm just a person. So this is an email that we got from a listener named Daniel. And he said, "Hi, Gabby. I'm 33, Caucasian, born male, and identify as a heterosexual male in an upper middle class household, 6'2", and easily control my weight." Wow, this is a dating profile. He didn't say that. I just was like, do you fish and enjoy the outdoors? Anyway, okay. "Essentially, I was born into a body and an environment that bestowed me with enormous privilege and plentiful resources, and I almost fucked it all up. My 20s were marked by addiction, heartbreak, confusion, and a desperate desire to connect with others to the extent that I often found myself in toxic and meshed relationships. Who among us?" I added that. "I justified the pain and depersonalization that I experienced by creating a narrative that was all leading to greatness, that I would write songs that would emotionally connect with other people and make my living as a musician." Yeah, it's a little embarrassing. It's not embarrassing, Daniel, at all. "My path towards recovery is part of my own perception, self-perception now. At 27, I stumbled into a very lucrative career path as a result of luck and my own status as a fit 6'2 cisgender male. I started a 5-year union apprenticeship as an HVACR mechanic." So now he's sober. He's been sober since March 1st, 2017. Congratulations. "In my mind, I believe we are all born equal into unequal circumstances. And I'm grateful for my recovery process, but I also feel a certain amount of shame for my position in the world. Because of this, I must be a superhuman. I must fix everything, build anything, play any instrument. Must be an attentive and supportive partner to my wonderful girlfriend of 3 years. I must be an HVAC technician with immense knowledge, skill, and work ethic, while also being empathic and understanding towards those around me. I also must never turn down an opportunity for overtime, because if I was to do that, I fear I would be cast as unworthy of employment. Then COVID-19 came." So this is a person that's always wants to be productive. We're cutting down a little bit of it, but "I've always insisted I pay the vast majority of the mortgage and bills, as I make about 4 times of what my partner does, but I've come to depend on their income more and more as I haven't been able to work for the past 4 weeks. And then a week ago, some people robbed him and took a bunch of tools from his work truck, like $3,000 worth of tools. And he's freaking out. I slowly came to the realization of just how little control I have and how much I'd been fooling myself, pushing myself to the breaking point and ignoring my emotions so I can handle what's right in front of me, because I don't feel like I have a right to fail." And then he's been crying a lot since his tools were stolen. Hmm. So this is, to me, a person who, and I think a lot of people deal with this, and me too, is that you put all of your self-worth into how much money you're able to make and how productive you can be. And then during a pandemic, you're not able to be that productive and you realize a lot of stuff is out of your control and you totally break down. So what would you say to someone like this?
Gosh, it's interesting because for me, Daniel's story really started in the dating profile part when he was introducing mm-hmm. sort of the basic stats of his life. It was a very like how an external person would perceive and value him. And what we heard him saying is that he didn't value these things really in himself. He was mm-hmm. they seemed to come with a lot of obligations. Like everything should come easy for me. I should be able to do this, this, and this because I have all of this enormous privilege. And mm-hmm. underneath that, there was a piece that really spoke out in terms of like what he felt he deserved out of all of that. Like, mm-hmm. I forget the actual like language that he used there, but I literally wrote down like, what do we deserve? Because mm-hmm. he didn't seem to feel like any of it was really his and he didn't know who he was and all of that. And now he's got this whole journey around sobriety and being vulnerable and being lovable and having value and worth, even when we're not perfect and not in control. And suddenly this sort of like victimization happens, right? He's mm-hmm. the victim of theft, and how is he supposed to take care of himself? And talk about like the other side of a coin, right? On the one hand is, here are all of these things that came to you that you didn't deserve necessarily. You did nothing to right. earn them. It's just sort of like the luck of privilege. And now on the other side, something that you have earned and worked for has been taken from you unfairly. Mm-hmm. And how do we reconcile a world where both of those things can be true? And what do we sort of make of all of that in terms of how we want to understand the world that we're in and our own sense of limited control, whether that's a good thing in the sense of inherit a privilege that we inherit, or a bad thing that we mm-hmm. can be the victims of bad things happening to us. Mm-hmm. So like, I think the part of your question was like, what would I say to somebody like Daniel?
Yeah.
I would really want to bring Daniel down to the level of what he's feeling. Because we see Daniel telling a lot of stories here about who he is and about how he sees himself in the world that he lives in. And
right.
And that's also something that I think happens with a lot of people who have an experience with addiction, is that we have, because I'm also a sober person in recovery, a lot of difficulty sometimes being able to stay grounded and in touch with our own feelings. It's easier in some ways to sort of escape to a more analytical storytelling, kind of a filter on our experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the pieces that Daniel's missing, is just like, how do we bear the guilt, which is what I think he's saying in the first part of his introduction, like the guilt of things that we don't deserve. And then the sadness mm-hmm. that we feel when we think we're doing the right things and something doesn't go the way that we feel like we have earned it.
Right.
Because there is no, like, there's no answer to that, right? There's no right. advice that I could prescribe for him.
Right.
I think, in fact, the healthier thing for him to be able to, like, if we're talking about using money as a lens to kind of live your life, like this is something that's a thing that's happening deeply within Daniel's feelings and his identity that's showing up as a problem with money. And money, yeah. money often is what points us toward places in our lives where we need to grow and change. And I mm-hmm. think that's what's happening here.
Yeah, I relate to this a lot because I think it's a lot of catastrophic thinking, in the sense that like whatever you've gotten to bring you to a certain place, you don't deserve it. And like you feel like, okay, then I have to work extra hard to deserve it. And then something that is just as out of your control, which is like getting robbed, is also somehow your fault? Like, oh, the ways in which I could make something my fault from any direction is truly a gift and an art.
Right.
And so I felt that with him where it was like, you know, so then having like any money that I have or any money that I've like been good with is some sort of trick and I fooled everyone and I don't deserve it. And any money that I've like lost, I did that. I'm an idiot. And so I think it's a way of having control. And during this time, during COVID, you're being forced to confront what you actually have control over, because a lot of times we can just like pretend, you know, or like go into our jobs or be like, well, I have control over how much I work. And then like you don't. And so I think loss of control is really fucking with people. And then again, the loss of control of getting robbed too is like right. a double whammy.
It's like the universe is trying really hard to send him this message. Really hard.
Yeah, which is like an unfortunate mode of delivery. But like, yeah, to be like, it is, you are not in control of everything. It is mm-hmm. not all on you. You have a partner. You're in recovery for addiction, which is a disease you did not ask for. Like, there's other things that are in charge, I promise. And you don't have to be the savior of everybody.
Yes. And that's such a good point too, that sometimes when we're looking for solutions, we want to look just inside of ourselves. And sometimes the solution is actually what we need to do differently in our lives, especially as it relates to like not always thinking that we have to be 100% in control of an outcome. Mm-hmm. Like the thing that actually needs to happen is that we admit our vulnerability to another person mm-hmm. and receive their help and support, especially mm-hmm. with what he was saying, you know, the sort of like the scent of self-worth issues. Like, I mm-hmm. wonder how much Daniel was really allowed to need things and feel things
right.
and ask for things, right. or if he was just told that he should be grateful all the time for all yeah. of the privileges he enjoyed.
Right. Grateful or have this position of being in control and in charge. And like, again, like being like a 6'2 man does not mean you're in control of everything, I promise.
Right.
And also, like, you know, he ends by saying that he's cried so much about the stuff getting stolen, which, like, absolutely. But a lot of times when money stuff had happened that was out of my control, I would be crying. But I would also be crying about, like, years of things that, like, have nothing to do with that. It just like, opens, like, a well. And so I think, like, think about why you're crying, but then write down, like, other reasons you might be crying. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Like, it's usually like opens a door that was like already blocked and like needed to be opened.
Yes. I mean, there is a way, like you heard me say earlier, that money often points us toward ways that we need to grow. Like, especially yep. if there are kind of like I sometimes will describe it as like a lens through which we see the world. Mm-hmm. And if we have a lens that's kind of, it's not working so well for us, we're either like seeing things this way, it leaves us exposed to more risk or is actively damaging. Mm-hmm. Rest assured, this is going to show up in some way in your money. So like to your point about see what else is happening, like why else you're crying when that's coming up, like we can ask ourselves, what is the lesson that I think I need to learn here? Which is sometimes like our quiet inner voice speaking up, yeah. or sometimes it puts a name on the pathology or the thing that is mm-hmm. actively harming us that needs to be tested against the reality of our lives in order for us to work on it.
Yeah. And loss of control is a big one. So
big one.
I feel you. Okay. We have a voicemail from a listener named Tiffany, who is a Black queer woman whose partner is pregnant, or she and her partner are pregnant. I don't know who's pregnant. Somebody's pregnant. Let's listen to it.
Hello. My name's Tiffany. I brought my partner, Rissa, with me on this one.
Hey.
Because I am admittedly a little intimidated about it. So we were actually living in Detroit when the pandemic first hit. We were planning to move to Washington, D.C., where we are right now, but we were not planning to move quite as quickly as we did. But when the pandemic hit, we said, let's just go on ahead and move up our timeline and get out there. We had to have quite a bit of money to be able to put down, like a deposit. The rent here is 3 times as much as our rent in Detroit was because, you know, East Coast versus Midwest. And since then, I have lost 6 people in Detroit, one of which being my cousin, who is 33 or was 33. It's jarringly clear to me that we did make the right decision to leave Detroit during this time because it was such a hot zone and DC isn't, but also the resources and infrastructure there are just not quite as strong as it is in DC. And so a lot of people just weren't able to protect themselves, namely some of the people in my circle. And again, all of these people are Black, and it's just devastating because I know no one in DC, but in Detroit, I know 6 people in the course of 3 weeks. So I will say that I've not really had as, I don't know how much more glaring of a example of how money seems to have saved me and my baby's life than that. I strongly believe that it would have been difficult for us to not contract COVID-19 otherwise. But I don't know that for sure. I do know that I'm glad that I will never have to find that out. I will say also maybe even a more clear example of money protecting us is we literally order all of our groceries through either Instacart or Amazon Prime right now.
Which we were not able to do in Detroit.
No.
At all.
No. It was just really hard because of where we lived, the neighborhood we lived in, but also just a series of infrastructure-oriented issues there that just are not in existence here. The city, D.C. is just smaller. Like, I mean, there's just no, there's so many things that are different here. But so that was really helpful because, you know, we don't want to get sick. And it's very clear that that's something that could happen.
So I want to talk to you, Amanda, about something that I picked up on here, which is like survivor's guilt in terms of having more money than the people around you. And what do you say to people like that come to you and are sort of like, I've moved up in economic class, or I'm able to afford things that people in my family and the people that I grew up around can't. And I feel like a survivor's guilt about it.
There's survivor's guilt. And then there's also survivor's isolation. In this point, like in this story as well, like,
okay,
there's what I hear Tiffany and Rissa is redefining sort of like who's in their pod, right? Like mm-hmm. being connected to your community, and your loved ones, but being very worried about how dangerous it is for you, literally, to be a member of that community and be in that environment and choosing something like choosing safety for you and your partner and your baby that's on the way, mm-hmm. That feels safer. But on the other hand, you know, because your primary imperative is obviously for like one's own life. We want to live, and we want to protect a child. But when that makes us feel really alone.
Mm-hmm.
On top of how guilty we feel, is a whole other sort of swirling and shifting sense of identity. And I hear Tiffany saying, like, she wanted to go into a whole description of, like, why Amazon Fresh works in D.C. but doesn't work in in Detroit. Like we want to be in that sort of like how we make sense of like the structural and institutional barriers to wellness and health and safety and opportunity and all of that.
Absolutely.
Because it's so painful to have to make those kinds of choices between how to protect yourself and your family unit, but feeling like that really cuts you off from a community and a family back in Detroit that's so important and feels like such a loss.
Yeah, I mean, it's also never been clearer the ways that the system is set up to particularly fail Black people, which we've seen in terms of the numbers in New York, in terms of what neighborhoods are hit with the most death, obviously in terms of the way that Detroit is hit harder.
Right.
You know, and I think like if you're a member of that community, it's almost like a widespread PTSD or like a widespread survivor's guilt, which I think it's a thing that people are really going to be dealing with for years after all of this resolves, quote unquote. Like, I think there's going to be a lot of psychological stuff going on. And we talked to someone in the first episode of this show about the psychological trauma that happens when you are a minority, a racial minority, and you move up in social or economic status, and what happens to you when that happens, and the sort of guilt and also like obligation you feel that white people don't feel. And so I think that's going to be even like tenfold for people that are like, okay, well, what's my obligation to the larger community? Why me? Why am I able to do this? And other people who look like me are not able to do this. And that happens financially, like in a regular year. Mm-hmm. And I think like what Tiffany and her partner are experiencing is like that times, you know, 1,000 during this particular time when people are dying.
Yeah, I think that there's going to be a lot of reckoning. I mean, there's going to be a lot of fallout. And I think that we need to have a huge reckoning. Like, if this country knows what's good for it, we will reckon with that, honestly, about how risk is so unequally distributed in this country. And I think of the emotional labor and the sort of like what it takes to be able to go out into a world and do your best, even though there is absolutely no guarantee and certainly a lot of evidence that effort and work that you put in is not going to be fairly rewarded by the system. And sometimes we can make our peace with that to a certain degree. Sometimes we know that there are sacrifices, but we can be realistic about it. But it's very different when the stakes are so elevated,
right?
Like they are now, where the degree of life and death has come up another level.
Right.
One of the things that Tiffany said that struck me so deeply was, you know, I know 6 people in my community in Detroit and in my family who've passed away. And in DC, I don't know one person who's going through what I'm going through. And so there's the isolation of grief too. Mm-hmm. And there's no way that grief can come without anger, because the root of anger is actually anger is very closely linked to injustice. When something happens that we think is out of whack and unfair. And it is so grossly unfair, and that anger is justified. And I think that we as a society need to validate and hold the where that anger is coming from.
Okay, we need to take a quick break and then we'll be right back. And we're back. Okay, so this is from Noah, this voicemail.
Hi, my name is Noah and I'm from Australia, and my experience is definitely one of the more positive and privileged experiences, because I've ended up earning more money than usual because I've been getting JobKeeper government payments. So effectively the government here is paying employee wages for businesses that can't afford to pay their own employees. After taxes, I'm earning $850 American instead of my usual $200 a fortnight. So that is a huge difference, and it's definitely weird to see money in the bank. I'm not used to that. Yeah, they were meant to be for 6 months, but they're reviewing it again at the end of the month now. So I don't know how long that's going to last for. But it is weird getting government payments because I feel like I'm getting money that I haven't earned because I'm working, but I'm earning more money than I would for doing the same amount of work. So that's kind of strange, but it also feels like I can't spend the money. And at the same time, like I can because I didn't like earn it, so it kind of feels like free money, but it's not like I did work for it, so that's kind of strange. I mean, I think a lot of fees that people normally have that they're not paying, like going to the hairdresser or getting their nails done, like I didn't really have anyways. I don't really go to get my nails done, but I do think that money spending is a constant that people know because it's something that we have to do all the time. And now that everything else that we're used to doing is so uncertain, spending money is a way to be in control of the situation because we are used to buying stuff to make us feel better. I ordered some clothes. That was an unnecessary purchase that I did to just like motivate myself because online uni has been really busy, way busier than normal. So I just told myself that if I got through my assessments that I had that for that week, that it was that I would order myself these clothes. So that has definitely been a way to feel more motivated and just, I don't know, necessarily more in control. But definitely it has been really hard to focus on stuff. So yeah, I also ordered a weighted blanket to help with anxiety. I think it's like it's been hard to have to just stay calm in all of this. I am very introverted, but still being at home and being so busy with work and with university, it's been, I've been like way more anxious than usual. So yeah, that's kind of my situation right now.
So what stood out to you from there? A lot of it was the buying stuff to feel safe, but what stood out from that to you, and also not feeling like you deserve money from your government, which you absolutely do. But
yeah,
you say your part first.
So, so how, it's like I picture Noah trying to put like the pieces of a puzzle together, and just sort of randomly grabbing two pieces and seeing if they fit. Like there doesn't seem to be any order of all of the different things that she's experiencing and she's lifting. And I think a lot of us mm-hmm. are feeling that way right now. So what are some of the things we heard? We heard like what it's like to make more money and have more money, what it's like not to earn that money, but to receive that money.
Mm-hmm.
What are the things that people are, she didn't say this exactly, but I was wondering how she felt about it. Like, you know, not going out and getting like your hair cut and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she wasn't doing those things anyway, but we're receiving a lot of messages right now too about our individual responsibility as consumers for supporting small business.
Yeah.
So some of us do feel like an obligation to be agents in the economy in a particular way right now. So like what I heard from Noah is like, just this sense of like she doesn't know who she is because it sounds like everything in her experience and in her environment mm-hmm. Has shifted so radically. And
yeah,
it was so curious to me that like buying clothes is an attempt to feel more motivated. And
yeah.
She wasn't saying what she needed to be motivated toward. But I do wonder.
I mean, to me, just like getting up in the morning.
Truly. But the clothing piece of it is often like we put on clothes like we put on a costume for our to perform our identities. So like mm-hmm. there could be a part of her that's like, I am this person who looks or feels like this. And this is a way for me to feel a little bit more grounded in myself. Like if I were giving advice to Noah, I would actually and you know, through the lens of money, mm-hmm. to not be in sort of a passive position or an undirected position relative to the choices that she has in front of her with the money that she's receiving. So to literally like what do I want to do with this $850 American, the equivalent of it? Like how much of that do I want to save? How much of it do I want to put toward XYZ that could help her feel like she is creating and constructing that identity in a new set of circumstances,
rather than it's just coming to her and there's no plan.
And not only that, but it's coming to her and she almost doesn't recognize it. Like she doesn't know who to be with all of these differences. So we can say like, and this is what I love about being a financial therapist, because we can work on the like the meaning side, or we can work on the tool side of money. So I would give her a sort of tool side, like a concrete task that I think would help her feel more. It would have a psychological and emotional effect.
I also just want to say, Noah, like, the government should give you all their money. Like there's this false idea that people have where they go, but I didn't earn it. You earned it by being alive. Trust me. Like you've earned it. Like it also the capitalist idea of needing to have earned money is like money's made up. And like if the government is giving out money, you take their money. And this is the type of thing where it stops people from applying for unemployment in the US because they go, well, I should pull myself up by my bootstraps. I shouldn't take help from the government. What do you think the government is here for? Take all their money. Take all of it. Anyway, that's my socialist rant of the episode. Okay, cool. Let's do the last voicemail.
Hello. So a little bit of context. Before COVID, I was on a grant program. So I was living abroad in the Netherlands. And I was doing research through a grant that was funded by the US government. And before COVID also, because I was living in Europe, I was very much looking forward to spending my whole summer really traveling across Europe. I was planning to go to Croatia, to Germany, to Greece, to Spain. I was really going to try to do it all. So that was really where I was trying to bank most of my savings and money before all of this. So then COVID happens, my grant is kind of suspended, so we were all told we need to come back home. I ended up leaving within 4 days. I had my entire little apartment packed up. I had my flight bought. So I got back and I have no income now. So I was supposed to be on this grant until September. And because it's a grant, I'm not able to apply for unemployment either, which is also very frustrating. Because if I had unemployment, I would feel less worried about my financial situation, mainly because, I would have some income coming in. Luckily, I was able to move back home once I came back. So I don't really have many expenses either. So whereas before I would spend most of my money on, you know, like rent and food and stuff, a lot of my food is being taken care of now. I am paying a little bit in rent, but, you know, not nearly as much as I would be if I was still in the Netherlands. So in a way, I feel a little more in control about my financial situation because I know that I have the support that I need. And I will have that for the foreseeable future until I'm able to find a job. But also in another way, I feel less in control because before I would spend most of my time thinking about what's the next thing I want to do, like where's the next place I want to go or the next experience I want to have. And now it feels like I'm spending all my time thinking about like, how can I find a job? What's this job going to be? Is it going to be something I like? Is the income going to be worth me doing something that's maybe not in my field? I think having those worries is one, something I was not even thinking, like it wasn't even on the table before. And two, it feels a lot more, you know, I'm competing with jobs with 33 million people who have just been laid off. And that does make me feel a little nervous about my financial future. When I look forward to what like 3 months from now is going to look like or 4 months from now, if I don't have some stable income, that's going to start to get really difficult. So yeah, I think that's where I'm kind of at right now. And thank you so much for sharing stories like my own. And I'm so excited to hear the episode and hear what other people are going through and what their experiences are like.
Thanks, Cheyenne, who has the same name as my little sister. So that bumped you right to the top of listenership. Just kidding. I picked your email because it was good on its own, I promise. So yeah, I mean, what the high rates of unemployment and competing with more people for jobs stuck out to me. What stuck out to you?
What stuck out to me is Cheyenne is asking like at what level should I be panicked here? Trying to sort of go
right.
There's this bullet point. There's this bullet point. Like I'm okay for 3 months or 3 or 4 months. That's good. I'm here with my family. That's good. But like, what happens to me after this initial period of safety?
Right.
And right. How have all the ways that I planned before in my life, like one of the things that I wonder too, how related they are is, what's the association that she has with planning? Like, she sounds like a person who has, when she has planned in the past, what she said is like, I was planning to go to Croatia. I was planning to save this money for travel. I was doing all these things. And so now when she's thinking about like, I'm in a situation where something pretty dire could be 4 months in the future, how can I make a plan for that? A, it's really tough to make a plan. And B, what's coming up for her when she does sort of like turn on that planning switch is all of these associations with loss. And the plans that have been lost before. And that's something that I'm hearing a lot from people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we went quick aside, like one of the things that can help us save money for a purpose is like when we give it a name. So it's not just like, this is my savings. It's like, this is my vacation fund. And we associate it with a vacation and we're excited and we align our behavior with it. We follow through.
Right.
The downside of that is then that becomes much more tangible for us when something happens to that. It's not just, whoop, that was money. It's like, that was literally this thing, which I had already bonded with. So I like psychologically and emotionally, I feel like what Cheyenne is, what's in front of her, like the work to do is to mourn some of the things that were her plans, were so important and vital and gave her life a lot of joy and structure. And to now be like, I don't want to work. Like, what I hear is like, I don't want to work on these plans. I want to be in the Netherlands. I don't want to be in my parents' house figuring out like how to compete with 30 million people to get a job.
Right.
I want to go back. That wasn't the plan.
And the plan is taken away from you, even if you did so well. So like saving up a bunch of money for a house and then being like, this in the fall, I'm going to buy a house. And then being like, no, I'm not.
Right.
And now you have all this money that you did, quote unquote, the right thing. What do? You know, I think you adjust, you just mourn the old plan and you use the money for a new plan.
Yes. But that's a process. Even when we get that logically, like we want to skip over the part where that hurts and that sucks.
Yeah.
But in order to be free of that and not carry it forward with us, in order, it's like sometimes it's so painful, the lesson that we'll tell ourselves that we need to learn, rather than feel it, is plans are stupid. You know what? It's better just to be hands off, because when you care about something enough to really work toward it, it can still get taken away from you. So why care and why try?
Right. Yes,
and I don't
absolutely
prescribe that. I'm just saying like that's one of the things that when we don't do the feeling work, sometimes there are very big unintended consequences of doing that.
Yes. And you know what? Save the money. Then if you don't want to use it for something different, or you don't want to divert it, or you're like, I don't need it for this other thing, just hold on to it and your plan will take a year longer, 2 years longer. And like, that sucks totally. And also, like, I'm have both. Like, I have money that I was putting away for something that like is not going to happen. I'll just hold on to it. And there's also money that I was going to use for certain things that are now need to be used for other things, need to be donated, need to be given to family members, mm-hmm. need to, it has a new purpose.
Right.
But you do, you are allowed to feel, you are, it's grief. Everyone is feeling grief, either for the delay of a plan or the cancellation of a plan, you know, and money that you quote unquote, again, did the right thing, saved. But then now the right thing doesn't matter.
The
but
right
it did
thing,
matter. Okay. It does. Yes. It does.
Right now, the yeah. right thing is a kick in the ass. In that, like, that's mm-hmm. all of the things that we, all the effort that we put into doing things that didn't feel good in the moment or as good as something mm-hmm. else could have felt in the moment. All of that sort of deferred energy is what is coming up and needs to be processed right now. Yes. All the planners that I'm talking to, those are the people who are experiencing the most grief in this moment.
All right, it's time to take one last break and we'll be right back. And we're back. I'm just going to do we're going to do one more listener email from someone named Blanca, and I'm going to cut it down a little bit. But basically, this is a person who has started getting their shit together, has always been from like a multi-generational bad with money family. And so they got a yearly bonus, a raise, finished paying off their car. They were building a 401k, all this stuff. They left a bad marriage last summer. We love that here. And then basically the state goes into lockdown for COVID and they have it's working out okay for them, but they're having a crisis of conscience about if continuing with their financial plan, continuing with building their 401k, continuing with paying stuff off is actually ethical or moral during this time, because it feels like profiting over the economic suffering of others from this deadly illness, even if it's not directly, but she still kind of feels like it is. There's donations supporting local businesses, helping people close to them, all this kind of stuff that they're able to do. For some people, the work from home situation is actually having a positive effect and allowing her to make more money. And she's been told, you know, being financially responsible is saving, is having all this stuff to keep yourself safe. But is this now, she feels, is this now just like greedy? So that is the email from Blanca. And I found that very interesting.
Do you want me to go first? Or do you go first?
Yeah. Like, do you, let's say you're like her and you've started doing all this stuff. Is it ethical to like continue doing your plan? Or are you kind of just, again, blaming yourself for failures of the government, which happens a lot here on the show?
this is, can we come back to actually blaming the government for failures as a topic at when we're done with this email?
No, we absolutely love that here on this show.
Okay.
I also think my investments are down, which, you know, c'est la vu, that's how investments go.
I do want to talk about that more. But I want to talk about Blanca too. So in general, like, mm-hmm. whenever somebody asks me a question, like, is it ethical to continue saving money or should it be used for XYZ? Like, that is a place where we're deeply over on the meaning side and mm-hmm. not on the concrete side of what's happening.
Oh, say more.
Individual financial life. Like, it's being presented like it's a binary choice. Like, we're trying to put these things into categories and we don't necessarily uh-huh. need to make it one or the other. Money, right. because we can sort of like, we can split it up, we can look at it, we can sort of be more concrete with it. We don't have to say something is all good or all bad. Mm-hmm. So for Blanca, I feel like what she's, the sort of like overall structure of the question that she's asking is like, are the choices that I was making before in terms of like the values that I had and the plans that I had, are those choices still relevant in the same way? And does that translate into the same amounts in terms of how, what I want to do with my money?
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. It does.
And so it doesn't have to...
Because the circumstances have changed.
Exactly. The circumstances have changed. So she can... I get this question, like another version of this question that I see a lot is around helping family members. And like, am I a bad person if I have my own financial goals while someone else is suffering in my family? And then they go into like, but this person was irresponsible and all the other things that we do to sort of like judge and jury that. Whereas when we are grounded in our own agency with money, then we are able to hold those values in a more nuanced way. So we can say like, these are my values. It's important to me to like have a life that looks like XYZ. It's important to me to support local businesses. It's important to me to be available and stable enough to help family members, et cetera. And those values translate to this many dollars for this and this many dollars for this and this many dollars for this. Mm-hmm. So these things are, right now we're seeing them as in competition with each other. And the goal should actually be, how do we integrate them together?
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting? Is that it is always the Blancas of the world who ask this question and never the Jeff Bezoses of the world. Pretty interesting that it's like, is it ethical for me to keep making money, says the person who makes $30,000 a year. And then the person who's about to become a trillionaire is like, no, let's keep going with this. Would love to keep being a trillionaire. Like, it's I think there's a lot of, especially at this time, I think in terms of money, there's a lot of personal responsibility nitpicking that I'm seeing among people. When like you giving away all your money is not going to help anyone. You're not Jeff Bezos. Like, you're not president of the United States. Like, you can absolutely help and like give and donate and like help people and like 100%. But there's the level of guilt that you're feeling is as if you are a trillionaire and you're not. And the trillionaire is feeling zero guilt. And I hate it.
And we have to be careful, too, about putting a face there. Like, it doesn't matter if it's Jeff Bezos or Jennifer Schmo. Like it's not about the individual human who occupies that position and how virtuous or not they are. The fact that we have a structure that can put someone in that position and what happens when any human is in that position, that I think is an important question for us to ask. Like I do feel like I can be so subjective about a lot of things, but I do feel
like
trillionaires, like a system that can result in trillionaires, that's not a system that is going to be like one of the trade-offs of that system. What it's not going to be able to do well is to take care of a wider variety of people.
Absolutely. It's the result of tax breaks and business structures that are exploitative. And I mean, it's a huge result of a lot of things. And then it breaks my heart to see like young people who really care, who feel terribly guilty that they have like an extra $5,000 and they're like, I got to get rid of this, which like does help. But also like, oh, why is the government not doing this?
Yeah, it's hard to move a big system. Like we're always solving the problem that came to the generation before us. Like, I see that very much in terms of like our psychological needs. Mm-hmm. Like the way that I'm parenting my children is very often an expression of what I wish I had gotten more of or less of when I was a child.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. even when we're developing a system, like this, the economic systems that America was built on are often like they were fighting against something before. And so we don't adapt instantly.
Right.
And it's one of our great vulnerabilities as people is our difficulty adapting when we need to. I mean, we see it with like climate change and all over the place.
Yep.
But let's not be downers. Let's not be downers.
No, we love to be a downer here on Bad With Money. We're very pessimistic/realistic here. So last question. What are some other basic essential tips that you can give to listeners as they battle their struggles with their relationship to money, you know, right now at this very heightened moment?
I think that we What I like to see people doing is taking a different sort of, like a more collaborative and conversational role with their money. Instead mm-hmm. of just trying to mm-hmm. top down, be like, this is something I'm going to control. I think what we need to do is do a lot more taking in and listening. So taking in and listening to how we're responding to like things that are happening with our money, with our job prospects, with our sense of like how the choices that we made before seem like they're still good choices or maybe not good choices moving forward. Because I think what happens too often is that people, when they feel uncomfortable, and this is just sort of like it's a function of how we experience stress and stress's mm-hmm. job of going, ooh, I'm going to make you feel bad. So you look at this and you deal with it so that I'll go away. Mm-hmm. So we want to go, okay, what can I do to make this yucky feeling go away? And instead, if we can learn to sort of like create a little bit more space, be more gentle with ourselves, be able to sit in some of these feelings that are coming up without it overwhelming us, and without us feeling like, oh my God, this feeling is going to kill me. Like, I don't want to be dramatic, mm-hmm. but I think like a lot of the
being
fear.
Being upset with the feeling
yeah.
for having the feeling.
Right.
While also experiencing the feeling.
Totally. Exactly.
Oh my God.
Like to just be able to ride that wave instead of tightening up and tensing up and resisting it. Mm-hmm. That is the key to resilience in these mm-hmm. circumstances, because they're changing so quickly. And the best way we can help ourselves to be adaptive, to feel grounded, to preserve our own bandwidth, to be able to mm-hmm. deal with this situation as it evolves so quickly, is to be able to sort of like to open up more space to feel and to balance our ability to feel and perceive what is right and wrong for us, and to really mm-hmm. integrate that with our ability to analyze information and options and make good decisions.
Absolutely. And be able to think long term when long term has never been less certain ever.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of I don't want to minimize the obvious stressors mm-hmm. and difficulties of this. That exists, and I'm not negating that. I'm saying that's there, and for so many of us, if not all of us, there is also an opportunity for a real reassessment and reframing here to make sure some of the choices that maybe had become just so automatic for us
yeah.
are still choices that we believe in and that we want to re-choose moving forward.
Yeah. And I hope a lot of that is directed towards our complacency with capitalism, our complacency with the healthcare system, our complacency with the minimum wage. I hope that at least after all of this tragedy, there is a refocusing on the ways in which money has played a role in this pandemic and how the structural things that need to change. I do look. I love a good being angry at individual people, but I think structurally, a lot of these problems are related to structure and even the lack of mental health resources and lack of ability to open up and talk about what's going on for you. I think it is playing a role, you know, it's playing a role for Daniel. It's playing a role for almost everyone who called in.
Yeah,
pretty much. So thank you so much, Amanda, for coming on the show. And where can people find you?
You can find me at amandaclayman.com. You can find me on Instagram at Amanda Clayman and Twitter at Amanda Clay.
And the podcast is called?
It's called Financial Therapy with Amanda Clayman. And you can find it in the Death, Sex, and Money feed.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I loved it.
So obviously everyone's world has been completely upended and people's money situations are a part of that. So I think a lot of stuff that stood out for me in the emails and voice messages that you guys sent is that there's uncertainty, obviously. There's fear. There's guilt. And a lot of it is universal. Like, we're all kind of going through similar things. And if you're not, at least the people who listen to this show have a lot of empathy and a lot of desire to help. So I think, once again, we come to this season's theme of control and using money to buy control. Either that control that's being bought is your own safety, or the control that's being bought is, how can I help other people? What can I do to fix this by myself, me individually? Like, we can do what we can do, and we absolutely should be helping people and doing what I see people doing, which is like sending money or sending food to hospitals or all the kinds of activism stuff, buying local, everything. But when you put the whole pressure of the world on yourselves, which is what I hear a lot of you guys doing, saying like, this is all my fault, this is all my fault, we're not seeing whose fault it actually is. And when we, again, this is like the whole point of the show Bad with Money. We take these things on as something we individually did, something negative about ourselves. Why aren't we more? When like the answer is we've been failed massively by the government, by those whose job it actually is to take care of this, by rich people. And I don't just mean like rich people. I mean like billionaires and trillionaires who are refusing to even remotely take a hit to save entire countries and cities and the world, which they probably could afford to do and not even sweat. So you got to just drop the self-hatred, self-catastrophizing, all of it that I see almost all of you who wrote in, and not just the people that we called out, but all of you who wrote in are experiencing. You're a good person. And being a good person sometimes gives you undue, I don't want to say delusions, but like the idea that you must or you are responsible for fixing everything. And you can fix what you can fix, but you cannot fix everything. And you are not a bad person because you can't fix everything. And what you can do is get the people who can fix everything to try to do that. You with your $5 are not going to solve structural racism. But you can try to be heard by the people that can. Thank you for listening. If you enjoy the show, please tell all your friends about it. Make sure you're subscribed to our show on Stitcher or wherever you find your podcasts. The show is produced by Tamika Weatherspoon. Our audio engineer is Brendan Burns, and our audio is mixed by Andy Christens. Our executive producers are Chris Bannon and Josephine Martirana. Original music is composed by Zach Sherwin, Mike Kaplan, and Jack Dolgen. Our theme song is performed by Sam Barbera. Bad with Money is a production of Stitcher. I'm Gabby Dunn, and yeah, I'll probably see you next week. And look, I never said that this show was positive. Okay, guys? I never promised that. Bye.